This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is, of course, our Rethink the Week. But as you've come to expect, we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the fall of 2019 at the impeachment hearing. He was assuring his father that everything would be okay, that his dad made the right decision by coming to America. And of course, as we know, nothing is okay. Not for him, not for his twin brother, not for the country, frankly, not for the world. Now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
It is our Rethink the Week. Sometimes I keep thinking it can only be 7 days. It feels like 70 days because this week has been beyond unbearable. And we have an interesting panel of guests. We have Dean Spiliotis back after his daughter's graduation last weekend. Dean is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. He also is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio, their sort of end of the week show. And I want to welcome Dean back and congratulate the papa on a high school graduate. Welcome.
That's right. Thank you very much, Arnie. Good to be back.
It's a pleasure. We have joining us again, Rick Newman. Rick Newman, I have known for decades. He was a former state rep when I was a state rep. He is now a lobbyist for New Hampshire Government Solutions. He lobbies for business. And I want to welcome Rick Newman back. How are you, Rick?
Nice to be here, Army. Good to see you.
Good to see you. And last but not least, it's been a long time, Will Wilkinson. He is the vice president of the Niskanen Center, which is based in Washington, D.C. It is a think tank that advocates environmentalism, immigration reform, civil liberties, and a national defense policy based on market principles. This is one of my favorite parts, though. Until August 2010, he was a research fellow at the Cato Institute, where he worked on a variety of issues, including Social Security, privatization, and most notably, the policy implications of happiness research. Oh, God. Now you have to come on and just talk about that at some point, Will, because I don't know what happiness feels like anymore. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So, this has been a tragic week. It has been a tragic week because of George Floyd. It has been a tragic week because it happened in a city that I feel like is my second home, Minneapolis, Minnesota. I used to work in the IDS building, you know, that building where you saw Mary Tyler Moore throw her hat up in the air as it was going up the escalator. I worked there. I actually lived on Loring Park, right outside of the out of Minneapolis. I went to school at St. Olaf College in Northville, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. But what we saw happen to George Floyd, because it was captured by video, something that wasn't possible maybe a decade ago, was a horrific murder by a cop who was also accompanied by three other police. And as I was watching the video, I had a conversation with some friends yesterday. And this was the essence of the conversation. And the reason I bring it up is that I posted it on Facebook and it's gotten such an incredible array of reaction. And some of it was very negative because it was about my white privilege. Some of it was, of course I would respond. And some of it was, aren't you afraid of the cops too? That was some of the reaction. But here's the thought of the day. I had a socially distanced conversation with a handful of friends. The question came up, if you happen to witness the events that led to Derek Chauvin, a white cop, murdering George Floyd, a black man, by placing his knee on Floyd's neck for over 8 minutes, would you have tried to stop it? How would you have responded? I've been replaying that scene over and over again in my head, and I pray I would have risen to the moment and that I would have intervened. But, so let me tell you right now, I've made a promise to myself. If I see an act of inhumanity by anyone, I will challenge it. I will question it. I will try to stop it. I cannot handle the agony of not knowing my response. I have to make a commitment to speak up and act up. We are our brother's keeper. So I'm going to start with you, Dean Scaliotis. And the reason I even sort of thought about this is that, as you know, I live in this old 1890 Queen Anne Victorian. And on my second floor, I rent to law students. And one of my law students about 4 years ago was a young Black student from the University of Delaware. He ended up living with me for 3 years. We live in white Concord, New Hampshire. Let me repeat, very white. New Hampshire is very white. Because I knew that my young Black law student would be coming in at 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, that if someone saw a young Black man coming into my house at midnight, they might do something like call the cops. So I did the mother thing. I walked around the neighborhood and explained to my neighbors that Scott lives with me. Scott is the equivalent of my son. Please do not react, because you see someone of color coming into my house and you might make an assumption. So as I see what's going on here and recognize that this is a story that happens being over and over again, but more importantly, it also raises a question for me, not only about my response, but about the culture within the police, the minds of the police. And I went back and looked at the police chief in Minneapolis, and he's kind of a scary fellow anyway. And I'm thinking, how do we fix this? And there's so much on our plate right now, and yet this seemed to be another version of the pandemic we're experiencing. It's the pandemic of racism.
A couple of initial reactions to the whole situation. One of the most disheartening, troubling thoughts that I've had in recent days is the realization that although we would occasionally learn about these kinds of situations in the past, you know, going back to Rodney King in 92, even further back than that, we always knew these kinds of episodes occurred, brutality, even potential homicide involved in some cases. What's happened now is that digital technology, smartphones, the ability of people to record all of this is really laying bare the reality of what we suspected in the past, but we're not quite confronted with in the way that we are now confronted with. I mean, there's no way you can look at that videotape of Mr. Floyd and not be horrified. Now, what if that had not been videotaped? What do you think would have happened? Would have been a very different situation. So what really is just disheartening to me is it's not that this is happening more frequently now. It's just that all of these episodes are being videotaped, digitally recorded on phones, being uploaded to the internet, going viral. And it's really kind of slapping us in the face, I think, in the way people who wanted to kind of turn the other way in the past, you just can't do that now. And so that's, you know, one of the things that I've really sort of been struggling with over the last few days is just, you know, we could probably right now name a half dozen other African-American individuals just in the last 2 to 3 years, at least, that have been similarly high profile episodes of brutality and violence. And it's very troubling. It you know, we'll see what results of this. The other thing is, I will say that I think that the George Floyd episode, as horrific as it is on its own, a lot of what we're seeing now is really a function of the spark that event provided. It's a buildup of African Americans being disproportionately killed and made dangerously ill by the pandemic. It's a long-term structural economic inequalities, unemployment, all the kinds of social inequities and other types of things that African Americans have had to deal with in our society that are still there under the surface. Just kind of, I mean, this really was. I've heard several people say either this was the last straw or enough is enough. So those have been the two things that I've been really thinking about, that what we're seeing now, I think, is a conflagration in which Mr. Floyd provided the spark.
Floyd
as bad
provided
as
the
situation
spark.
Was.
Right.
Yeah.
So Will, as I've been watching the events around, it's not just that African Americans are outraged. I think there's been so much simmering since Donald Trump got elected. We're so exhausted by the lies. We're so exhausted by the distortion of the response. We're so appalled at there are no norms left. There's no respect for law. You know, he can lie 1 minute and then change the lie the next minute. That in a lot of ways, it's George Floyd is kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back for all of us, for every young college student, for every climate change kid, for someone who's, I mean, I just feel like it was a way for us to finally sort of blow up. And it started with this incredible act of humanity based on a video, but I think it really sort of triggered this quilt of misery that's been going on, and we needed an opportunity to explode, Will.
Yeah, it really did have the feeling, does still have the feeling of a cathartic release, that there's this pressure that's been building up that, you know, had to go somewhere. I think one of the things that we're exhausted by is just the brazenness of the constant displays of impunity that we get from people in power. Yeah. So the Trump administration is just, you're saying when the looting starts shooting, well, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. The guy's been looting the country for, 3 years now. Right in front of our faces. And, there's no sense of contrition or, there's no, sense of conscience. And that's what really struck me about the murder of George Floyd, was, Derek Chauvin, or Chauvin, or however you say it, I'm giving you the French pronunciation, I guess. He just didn't care, right? There was something about seeing him with his neck on the man's, his knee on the man's neck, and Floyd is begging, desperately begging for his life. There's not even a glimmer of compassion or any sense that, he needs to change course. In fact, and this is one of the things that I think we get from Trump too. There's just this sense of malicious immunity.
What you are saying is that, so as you were looking at the cop, I am seeing Trump, because I see him putting his knee on all of us. There's an article by Dahlia Lithwick saying America is gasping for air. We are gasping for air. Rick, there is no question. We're gasping for air because we're not being given the facts. We're gasping for air because we don't even know what the rule of law is everywhere. We're gasping for air because they manipulate the truth. I mean, I listened to Attorney General Barr came out and had a 2-minute press conference and didn't take any questions. And he was supposedly responding to the George Floyd event. And what does he do? He immediately points a finger at those radical leftists and says, we have to go after the radical leftists. He's already put the spin on it, Rick. And I'm looking at him going, you're doing a freaking Mueller thing again. You know, before the Mueller report is even released, you tell us what the conclusion is. It turns out not to be the conclusion. But again, I feel like I'm being manipulated and I'm not being spoken to, and no one's being honest with me. And when you looked at that cop, I think you're absolutely right that what Will saw was kind of what I saw, which was, it might as well have been Donald Trump with his knee on him.
Donald Trump has made racism cool. He's made it okay. He, for the last 40 years, before that even, I mean, since the signing of the Civil Rights Act, America never stopped being racist, of course, but racism wasn't okay. So people who were, racist in their bones knew they had to kind of suppress that attitude, at least publicly. And some people became enlightened and some people evolved. And we even saw George Wallace at some point in his life admit that he was wrong. And then we moved through the years, and then we have a black president, which ironically is followed by the most racist person to hold the office since Andrew Johnson. And Trump Nat, when I saw that video, just what you just said, you look at the look on that policeman's face as he sort of looked around at the crowd. Video.
He was distracted. He was like, this is my foot and this is the rest of me.
He didn't care.
I know.
It was being videoed. There, you know, 10 years ago, I think a policeman, knowing he was doing something bad and noticing that someone was videotaping him, would have cared at least that he was being videotaped. That the look on that guy's face was ambivalence. He could care less that he was being videotaped. He was going to show this black man who was boss. And for 8.5 minutes, he stuck his knee on his neck and didn't give a damn about the consequence. That is right at Donald Trump's feet.
Well, and the idea of the lack of accountability, the CNN did a quick sort of look at this cop. The Minneapolis police officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck had 18, I'm gonna repeat that number, 18 previous complaints against him, the police department says. And unfortunately for Amy Klobuchar, one of those complaints happened when she was the Hennepin County prosecutor.
Oh.
Dean, 18. Now, I don't know about you, but I posted something on Facebook. Remember in 1994 when the Criminal Reform Act that came out and they included in that law, three strikes and you're out? Remember three strikes and you're out? Mm-hmm. And that was all, but this guy has, no wonder he didn't care. No wonder he didn't care they were filming him. He was hoping that it was in color and not in black and white. Because what? There is no accountability. If this guy had so many complaints and basically nothing happened, what made him think that something would happen this time? The fact that he was on video didn't even give him a wrinkle. I mean, and that's where I think when you begin to see this, you have to start asking, what is the message that's being sent to the police force? And this is the same cop who was at a Trump rally, who was so grateful that Donald Trump would be president. Why? Because he would release the handcuffs off the cops so they basically could do what they wanted to do. I'm thinking, listen to that mentality, and then you begin to wonder, no wonder African Americans are afraid of the cops. Because guess what? There is no justice.
Yeah, you know, this is why reforming the criminal justice system, police behavior, et cetera, has been such a challenge. You know, the traditional narrative has been that, a particular individual is an outlier or a bad seed or a bad apple, or, you know, it basically is kind of a lone behavioral problem. But, you know, this happens frequently enough. This is not the first police officer to have a long list of complaints and potential, in some cases, disciplinary actions. And so you have to look at the training, you have to look at the kinds of people who are recruited, the recruiting process. I mean, this is just I was reading somewhere this morning that there are thousands of individual police forces in this country, with some thousands and thousands. It was a remarkably large number. And the question is, how do you systematically engage in institutional reform for a system that is so fundamentally fragmented, particularly if the message coming from the top, from the commander chief, is not particularly helpful in that regard?
Well, so Will, do you do it state by state, or do you do it universally? Why should accountability be an accident of geography? Why should the cop in Minneapolis live up to a different standard than the cop in Houston, number one? And I mean, I think that's part of the problem too, is that maybe we need to have the federal government step in and say there's got to be some kind of process where at least you know that this is the bottom line. You know, I mean, 18 complaints, Will. 18. Oh my God, what kind of temperament did this guy have? He's clearly not an officer of the peace. He's an officer of complaints.
Yeah, it's absolutely outrageous, but it's a systemic problem through our law enforcement system. And I think the biggest policy cause is something that is known as a legal term of art as qualified immunity, which is a kind of legal fiction that has been. It's a bit of legislation by the courts. You know, part of the Civil Rights Act of 1871, part of the, you know, Reconstruction Acts, was a provision, it's like section 1983 of the U.S. Code, that allows individuals to press civil suits against law enforcement officers. And this was targeted toward the, you know, KKK at the time, who would, you know, use their authority as the sheriff or as the police chief to, you know, run a racial campaign of terror. And if they were legally liable for any damages they caused, that creates a powerful incentive. Over time, that's been eroded. It's come back and it's been eroded again. But currently, it's the, you know, it's called qualified immunity, which means there's immunity in certain circumstances. The idea is supposed to be to shield public officials from having to deal constantly with the hassle of lawsuits, you know, legal discovery, you know, having to finance their defense. You could, you know, like if you're just suing people constantly, you could, you know, bankrupt them. It's supposed to protect people who are, you know, doing the public's business from that kind of legal harassment. But the way it's been interpreted, you know, gives police officers not qualified immunity, but something close to absolute immunity. It becomes almost impossible to hold them accountable in any way. And this kind of behavior is a direct reflection of the fact that nobody can really touch the police officers. Exactly. And that really screws up the whole system of accountability.
So Ken, as a lawyer in the crowd, as I'm listening to Will talk about this, Slate.com's Mark Joseph Stern just wrote about that. And it turns out he said the Supreme Court can address this. It is time.
Well, they do have a case, yeah.
And they have a case in front of them right now that they could actually use to address this. But now you see what's happened. I mean, that's you have a cop who assumes that there's no accountability after 18 complaints, and then you have a Supreme Court who, unfortunately, the way they've done the interpretation, there is no accountability. It has given them a license to do what they're doing.
Well, that's true. And as Will was saying a couple of go-rounds ago, you know, this particular officer had displayed such arrogance and hubris, and knowing that he's not going to be accountable, could do anything. But I just want to turn it a little bit also, you know, there were three other police officers standing right there. And, you know, Arnie, your opening salvo was, gee, if I were there as a bystander, not a cop, you know, I'd like to think that I would have done something. But these guys were police officers, and they did have the authority to stop a crime in progress. They could see, they even, I think one of them may have even mentioned it to him, that it looks like he's out. But they not only didn't stop this murder from taking place, but they also kind of prevented, got in the way of any bystanders who, you know, they kept people at bay. You could see the behind the woman with the camera, the third officer came off her, towards her or him, and, you know, almost pushed them back. And then another guy over on the side, they pushed them back. And, you know, these cops enabled this to take place. And that, you know, for all the, Arnie, you're right, we are all frustrated and scared and angry from COVID-19 and being locked up in our own homes, and Trump's lies, 3.5 years of, you know, frustration that has built up and built up. But George Floyd's murder just, this is the world where Black folks live, Arnie. This is the world where every Black family lives every single day. And it's not just the fear of being murdered. And they do all, every parent, you're irresponsible as a parent if you do not have the talk with your child and say, you know, this is a risk that you can get killed. But also during COVID, it's highlighted how Black people get worse health care and worse access to health care. They have worse times economically, both when society is working at full employment, you know, and also being unemployed. I mean, so we're going to have to address the systemic racism. That's the turning point that this has to be for America.
So Rick, what scares me is we've known this for a long time. I mean, Dee mentioned the fact that now it's a movie. Now it's on video. Well, obviously we've heard it before. For whatever reason, we chose not to believe it before. You know, we know about the economic inequality. We know about the different life expectancies if you're Black versus being white. We know about the underlying conditions. It's like all of a sudden the pandemic is like, oh my God, it's kind of like our universal video. That's what it is. That's what the pandemic is. It's a big video. You know, now we're seeing it because the bodies are going up. Now we're seeing it because the percentages are going up. That's why we are all gasping for breath. So Rick, we have an election coming up in 2020. What's the obligation of Joe Biden now? What do we need to hear from him other than I might pick an African-American woman as my VP? Sorry, that's just not enough, no cigar. But I wanna know, what do we expect from him to say? And should he just say this is outrageous, or should he be more specific?
Well, you know, whatever he says is gonna be viewed through the lens of him being a candidate for office. So I'm not sure that he can, you know, there's a magic speech he can give. I will say, I appreciate the fact that he has made a statement, that he's come out, try to talk to the country. I think he needs to, one of the things he could do that would be very important would be to name at least some members of who the people would be in his cabinet, and have, whether he's got to buy the time on national TV or what, to announce that and have people talk about these kinds of issues. I think if he were to at least name a person who was going to be his attorney general, and have that person discuss the way they might take a view of these kinds of issues in depth, I think that would be a really good thing for him to do. I don't think he could just sit in his basement for the next 5 months and just let us watch Donald Trump, you know, implode. Remember, Trump has gone from, you know, lying about the crowd at his inaugural now to lying about how many people are dying from COVID, and to lying about who's causing trouble at the riots that are taking place. And that evolution is going to continue, and he's going to do everything he can to suppress votes. I think he has to give people hope. That's what we don't have right now. There are two things. People are afraid, and government is supposed to protect you, whether it's your local PD or the army keeping you from the Russians invading us, from the 60s. And government is also supposed to give every one of us hope that we can improve our lot in life. Right now, we're afraid and we have no hope.
Well, you know, because we're going to have to end this first half of the segment, is that Rick mentioned that he should start naming some of the people in his cabinet. I've been saying that for a long time, Rick, so I'm totally on the same page. But I actually think that naming his attorney general right now might be one of the most powerful salvos he could have. EPA, you know, they cut ribbons, they show up, they do whatever. But the attorney general has real power. We've noticed it. His name is Bill Barr. And as almost an antidote to Bill Barr, that would be a pretty powerful statement. Does he have the guts to do it? And who do you think he should appoint, given what we're seeing right now?
Kamala Harris, obvious choice.
You think that's Rick says Kamala. Who do you think, Will? Or do you think it makes even sense?
You know, I don't have a firm opinion on it. I'm not sure it would be somebody that, you know, ran for president this go round. I think it's interesting that both Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar, who are both former prosecutors, have had, you know, scandals involving their unwillingness to charge police for violence against people of color. And I think that speaks to the systematic nature of the problem, that you can't be a prosecutor and get elected unless you promise to be tough on crime. And part of the reason that you can't is that you won't have the support of the police, which you need as a district attorney, if you, you know, don't toe their line. Immunity from legal action distorts all of the incentives all the way through the system.
Well, and let me just go to Dean before we have 1 minute left of this half. And that is, Dean, I agree with Will. I would not pick anyone that ran for president, because in a lot of ways, I want to have a political moat around the attorney general. And just by picking Amy or Kamala, you've kind of waded into the presidential politics of the last couple of months. And in some ways, I want someone to be a little more, I don't know, a little more removed from the politics and more embraced about the idea of right and wrong and being a champion for that.
Well, you know, we talked about this many times, Arnie, and you know, I think it's a bad idea. I'm not a fan of the appointing the cabinet official. It's going to create an additional three-ring circus of distraction. You appoint Kamala Harris Attorney General, we immediately get into a war within the Democratic Party over whether or not she's truly progressive and about her record in California. It's, you know, I think Biden can do things like convene senior advisors for a roundtable, come up with policy, et cetera. You know, he's doing a reasonable job now of just kind of being a general stark contrast to President Trump. But the, you know, I think if they can get the vice presidential pick correct over the next 4 to 6 weeks, that's an accomplishment. To start picking cabinet officials, you know, that's just my opinion. I think it's a bad idea.
All right, we have to go to a break. This is the Rethink the Week with The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will be back shortly.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. That was the day one of the worst race riots in American history began in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In a frenzy of anti-black violence, a white mob destroyed virtually the entire black neighborhood of Greenwood. Over the course of the next 2 days, as many as 300 mostly black residents were killed. Black Wall Street had been burned to the ground, leaving 10,000 homeless. The day before, Dick Rowland, a young black man, tripped as he boarded an elevator at his job. He fell against the young white woman elevator operator. When she shrieked, nearby department store employees assumed she had been assaulted. Rowland was arrested, and newspapers fanned the flames of race violence and vigilanteism. And on this day, white racist mobs surrounded the Tulsa County Courthouse, where Rowland was being held, and demanded he be turned over to them. Returning black veterans had become increasingly assertive about their rights as citizens. They marched to the courthouse armed in an attempt to prevent Rowland's lynching. When the vets refused to disarm in the face of the demands by the white mob, gunfire ensued, touching off 16 hours of fighting that literally decimated the community black workers and professionals had built up over the course of decades. The National Guard was called out, mainly to disarm and round up black residents of Greenwood. Witnesses reported that Greenwood was bombed from the air by police and by Sinclair Oil Company planes. The history of the riot was buried for more than half a century. It would take until 1997 for the Oklahoma State Legislature to set up a commission to uncover the bloody details, which produced a 200-plus page report and recommended millions in reparations.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly, I simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? Get ready for me, love, 'cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Don't bring around a cloud of rain on my parade.
All right, Monday par deux. Joining us on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson is Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, Will Wilkerson from the
Niskanen Center.
Niskanen Center, I'll get it right. And Rick Newman is a lobbyist in the great state of New Hampshire. So I'm going to go with you, Rick, to start. Since you are a business lobbyist, let's talk about reopening. And in a lot of ways, one of the things that we've been talking about with reopening is the idea that somehow we are looking at fewer numbers of people, you know, getting COVID, fewer hospitalizations. People are now learning how to sort of operate on a sort of social distancing perspective. And I am wondering your thoughts about the reopening of the economy, given what just happened because of George Floyd. And the reason I say that is, as I'm looking at New York City and Brooklyn, and as I'm looking at Minneapolis, and as I'm looking at Houston, and as I'm looking all over the country, I am seeing thousands and thousands of people, not social distancing, not wearing masks, obviously right on top of each other. And just as we're trying to figure out how to sort of ooze back into an economy, this happened. What does this mean for reopening the economy. And I think you can't put it into a silo by itself, because in fact, it is going to impact the reality of the facts on the ground, Rick.
Well, I agree it is. And the thing for us who live here in New Hampshire is, you know, we have a very different experience than people who live in New York City or Chicago or Miami. I mean, I think you can reopen New Hampshire. A lot of businesses are going to reopen this week, and some already have in some degree. So we are kind of isolated here. We're in this northeast corner of the country. We don't have the same problems. Did this sure set back reopening efforts for major cities or urban areas? I mean, first of all, I don't know how much longer this riding is going to go on, and the damage that's being done is going to impact businesses being reopened. We're looking at a long, hot summer, I think, in my opinion.
So, Dean, as I'm looking at this, and I understand what Rick is saying. So if you live in sort of a rural area, if you're in South Dakota or Nebraska, you're not going to have the same thing. But let's be honest here. Where is the great economic generators in this country? It's in urban America. I mean, if I hear Cuomo say it more than, 3,000 times, how much money have we been sending to the federal government versus you, Mississippi? So I'm looking at all these urban areas exploding in these riots, recognizing that it's not just the rebuilding and the reestablishment of stability in those communities. It's the idea that this is happening in the middle of a pandemic, where breathing on someone, being too close to someone, spitting on someone. I don't know about you, but when I get angry, I spit. And a lot of people are angry. And I am looking at this and I'm just horrified, because now it really is now a pandemic on steroids.
Yeah. Well, you watch some of the, as you said, some of the scenes in various cities around the country. And, I've kind of been monitoring different parts of the country where I have friends and family and professional interest. And, you see how carefully the mayors and governors are rolling out these, yellow phase, green phase. And that just got blown out, got completely blown away over the weekend. I mean, there's suddenly just thousands of people out congregating. A lot of people were wearing masks, but by no means everyone. And those are precisely the kinds of environments where, as best we understand this virus, large-scale transmission can occur. And, we're going to see what happens in a few weeks. And what several people have mentioned, and I had this thought as well, if in 3 or 4 weeks it turns out that there aren't spikes, well, then you learn something about being together in those kinds of environments. But everything we know so far leads us to believe that there will likely be some additional upticks in these cities. But, I think it's just the psychological impact of all of this, of the level of unemployment, of the kind of the hopelessness, the looting, the economic dislocation, and thinking about what it would really take to have a place like Manhattan or San Francisco or Chicago. I've lived in two out of three of those cities, and I visited the other one many times. Those places are teeming with people, high-rise office buildings, retail shops, streets, cultural tourism, et cetera. The reality of how far away we are from getting back to that kind of level of economic activity is really sort of a frightening thing to behold.
So Will, as the libertarian in the family, should they be writing another stimulus bailout bill? And in light of what has just happened because of George Floyd, it almost seems to me that what we're realizing is we need now more reinforcement at the city and state level than we needed even before this. Because not only is there going to be a rebuilding as a result of the destruction from the riots, there may be a requirement to respond again to the pandemic. And what you're suddenly realizing is that this is what cities and towns do. It's the firefighters, it's the cops, it's the municipal, transit workers. I mean, these are all the things now that were being so cratered because of the pandemic and now because of the rioting, that how does Mitch McConnell not embrace something where the states are responded to? It is going to set everything up for failure, especially that precious economy that Donald Trump wants to will back.
Well, you'd think he'd want to do something about it, but as far as I can tell, the GOP's plan is to use the fact that the economic slowdown is absolutely devastating state and municipal budgets to coerce them into reopening. Like it's like starving somebody into going to work. So if you don't give them money, their budgets are just absolutely wrecked. They have no alternative but to reopen their businesses so that they can continue getting tax revenue and funding their city's social services. And the whole point of that is just to create an illusion of normality, the illusion that the pandemic has been successfully managed by the Trump administration. They failed so horribly, you know, we're now into a six-figure death toll, that their best idea for how to cover that up is to kind of just pretend it didn't happen and act like it's done and we're back to normal and like claim credit for something that never existed. It really is this crazy reality distortion thing going on. There will be some kind of fourth coronavirus relief legislation, but McConnell sure hasn't been in a hurry about it. He's been sandbagging pretty well because he really does want to use the exigency of states and cities as leverage.
So, Rick, I think what Will is saying is absolutely true. The problem, again, I'm going to mention that, you know, boy, the George Floyd riots are really going to screw that idea up, because people are, if it does turn out that we have another spike with this pandemic, if I'm afraid to go shop before this, I am going to really be afraid to do anything and leave my house before this. So I don't know what kind of economic activity. I mean, you're going to open up, but who's going to show up, Rick? That's number one. And number two, what I don't think Donald Trump quite comprehends is, you know what businesses need? They need frickin' schools. And you know why they need schools? Because kids have to go somewhere. Because if kids aren't in school, parents aren't going back to work. And there's kind of it's so ironic that he doesn't understand that it is this infrastructure of state and local government that makes it possible for the economy to flourish. And somehow he thinks that they're not related when they're so incredibly related. And you can force an economy back. What you can't force is the revenues that have been lost to suddenly show up.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, and if you just look at our little city of Concord, New Hampshire, look at all the businesses that cater to the people who work in Concord, New Hampshire. And if those people aren't going back to work, those businesses are all going to fail. I'm just thinking about the legislature. There are restaurants that make a lot of money just because 400 members of the legislature meet for 6 months, and there's staff, and there's lobbyists, and there's public who come to testify, and they frequent the restaurants and what have you. But, you know, one thing I want to say about what the Republicans have done is a couple of times, sometimes they tell the truth. And here's the time, Mitch McConnell, don't forget, said his number one priority is to make sure that Barack Obama failed. That was a Mitch McConnell quote. Mitch McConnell also said recently, as far as I'm concerned, the states can use the bankruptcy laws. We're not going to bail out blue state voters. Now, of course, they backed off of those comments. But that shows you what they're really thinking. I think they really see this as an opportunity to punish states that they see as blue states. And that's where they're focused on. They're looking at, they keep talking, look at what Trump's saying all day today, the failed Democratic mayors, when he's talking about Minneapolis and other cities that are having rioting. He can't get the partisanship out of his mind, and he views these things that he's created as an opportunity to punish those states that voted against him.
All right, we have to talk about at least one other thing before we let you guys go. Dean, let's talk about Donald Trump's war on Twitter. What the H is that about? This is a man who has had such an incredible love affair with Twitter, and he is so offended because Twitter made some comment, I think it was about absentee balloting or mail-in balloting, where they were making this incredible fiction up, but he is making his own party apoplectic. The Hill had a wonderful article, GOP deeply divided over Trump's social media crackdown. And the article said, conservatives are deeply divided over President Trump's executive order directing the federal government to consider stripping some of the legal protections afforded to the social media platforms. The order, which we're not even sure he has the authority to do, which came after Twitter appended a fact check to one of the president's claims about mail voting fraud, would ostensibly make it easier to sue the social media platforms over content posted by the people who use their websites. Well, the first person you'd be like shutting down would be the president of the United States, because there's like 98.9% of practically half the stuff he says isn't true. It's not fact-based. But it's almost like he needs another war. It's like he cannot operate in stability. He has to operate in hostility.
Think about the irony of that. I mean, Trump wants to take away the limited liability protections that Twitter has against people posting false things. Trump is probably the guy who posts the most false things on Twitter of anybody. And I got to tell you, Joe Biden agrees actually with Trump about that. So, you know what? And so do I. I don't think people should be able to make billions of dollars in profit by letting and having a part of their marketing be, you can say whatever you want on our platform. It's going to be seen by millions of people, and we get, but we take no responsibility for it. Okay. Like Trump tweeting that Joe Scarborough murdered that girl in Florida, which is devastating to that, to the woman's family, claiming the woman was having a sexual affair with Joe Scarborough, the guy who's the widower, 19 years later, still mourning his wife. He ought to be able to have an opportunity to go to court. And if he could show that Twitter knew that Trump was lying about that and Twitter let it up anyway, Twitter should pay. That's what
I hear you. So, Will, how do we do this? You have the Twitter response, and then you have the Facebook response. Zuckerberg says, you know, we're just a generic platform. We have nothing to do with this. We're going down a slippery slope. This is, you know, now you want me to start, you know, policing political speech, policing this. That's not my job. It's to sort of pick the winners and the losers, or do that kind of policing. Is there a safe harbor here? Is there a way to make sure that, you know, horrific things that are said on Twitter and on Facebook are somehow restricted or labeled or coded, and at the same time, not give Donald Trump what he wants? I mean, I don't even know what it looks like, Will, and if it's even possible.
It's very, very difficult. I mean, it's the problem with speech generally. You know, if people say dishonest, terrible, hateful things, but it's dangerous to set a precedent of having somebody with power making a decision that what this person has said is so bad that they shouldn't be allowed to say it, because, you know, look who would have that power right now. It would be Donald Trump. It would be like his federal communications bureaucracy, right? So I think it's dangerous to, you know, set the government up as the censor, as the arbiter of what adequate or responsible speech is. So I don't think the problem is, you know, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. You know, it just says that if somebody posts something on your platform, you're not considered the speaker. They said it, you didn't. Yeah. What's, I think, more concerning is the way the platforms use dishonesty, conspiracy theory, divisive, toxic, racist, whatever speech, and monetize it the way that they encourage it. And that has something to do with the business models of these companies that have to do with getting clicks for advertising money. And so if I were to look into how to change it, it would have more to do with changing the incentives of these companies. It might be that Twitter and Facebook wouldn't be possible in a world where they just have to charge people a fee to use their service, and can't make money just off of clicks and advertisement impressions, right? Like there's something really, really screwed up about that model that leads people down crazy rabbit holes, and foments a kind of toxic polarization. And I really think it has to do with the advertising-based business model. And I would do something about that before I would start messing with just the general principle of free speech.
Actually, that's kind of brilliant, Will, because in a lot of ways, it is the algorithms, it is the clicks, it is the monetizing. And we actually saw it in journalism. Remember, you know the old expression, if it bleeds, it leads? I mean, you wanted the most sort of horrific story on the front page because people might pick up your paper and pay for it. Well, this is an extension of that. It really is, only on a level that we could never quite have comprehended when we were saying this. And if all of a sudden you did what people would be horrified to do, you actually made people pay for using Twitter or pay for using Facebook, well, they're not going to make as much money. And as I mentioned to you before, Mark Zuckerberg, since the beginning of the pandemic, has seen his net wealth increased by 45%. 45% since the beginning of the pandemic, Dean Spiliotis. He's now worth $80 billion, all right? So clearly, whatever's happening on Facebook, it's been a cool lot of cash, pile of cash for him. And there's obviously a lot of stuff that he can monetize. But if he takes away some of that monetization, then guess what? You're not going to have, I think, the kind of cruelty and lies and despicable stuff that you see on Facebook, because it's not going to be incentivized.
This whole issue of how to police social media, you know, it's just a huge issue. And, you know, we've seen Donald Trump talk about, you know, kind of direct his ire at Twitter this time around. But, you know, the Bill of Rights talks about government not infringing on your free speech. It doesn't necessarily say the same thing about private corporations, but these platforms, like whether it's Twitter or Google or Facebook or Instagram, which I believe is owned by Facebook, or Snapchat, take your pick, they've had such a profound impact on how we acquire information, how we consume it, how we respond to political stimuli. The magnitude of the problem is such that I don't have any easy answer for it. I'm still kind of thinking, you know, to what extent and if any should Congress be getting involved at this? The Trump executive order, that was just Trump being Trump. I mean, my understanding from reading the reporting was that he was so angry that he said he was going to issue an executive order, and then they basically had 24 hours in the White House to figure out something for him to sign. So I think, you know, that's kind of a sideshow. But there is this bigger, more profound issue of the ways in which these platforms have given other countries, bad actors, whatever you want to pick, access to our political discourse in a way that just was not there before.
Do you think that that's something that could be addressed, that since it's a private company and not a government, as you said, Dean, could that be addressed through maybe antitrust laws? Because these platforms are able to amplify these voices and give everybody a platform precisely because they're monopolies or oligopolies.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good question for a lawyer. You're the lawyer in the group.
That's why I asked the question.
I don't know. You know, I mean, I think Zuckerberg's response to all of this about not getting into the truth determining business.
He wants to be a billionaire virgin. I know nothing. I'm sitting here, where am I?
You know, we're going to get into the schedule. What is truth? You know, and truth, yes. You know, one person's, you know, is truth relative. And it's, you know, it's amazing that given for so many years, conservatives argued that there is this kind of absolute truth rooted in particular cultural and intellectual traditions, and now it's, you know, our truth versus your truth.
All right, so Rick, I want to end with this. You're not allowed to say fire in a crowded theater. That's not allowed. And when you look at the kind of stuff sometimes that's coming on Twitter and on Facebook, it is the equivalent of saying fire in a crowded room. I mean, it is not just toxic. It causes death. Is there no standard? And that's the part that sort of gets me crazy. And what Donald Trump was offended by wasn't even that they were removing what they said. They were just saying, let's flag it. It may not be so true. And everyone knows he lies anyway. So his Twitter followers are going to ignore, maybe it's untrue. But I mean, but even that was offensive to him, Rick.
Well, the thing is, look, at Alex Jones said that the shooting at Sandy Hook was fake, and he's being sued over it. And he's going through, now he has freedom of speech. He can say what he wants, but that goes with the, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You can't just make stuff up and lie about people and say these children weren't real, they're actors and all this. Well, guess what? He found out you can't do that. So I think the same standard should apply to Twitter and Facebook and other social media platforms. Why should they be given special treatment? If they're gonna make money from the fact that somebody puts up some crazy conspiracy theory that there's a child slave colony on Mars, and they're making money out of that, and they know it's false, then they should be able to be held accountable. But Trump's, I have to say, it may be the very first time I agree with Trump that we should take away that exemption. But I don't understand Zuckerberg's reluctance to say, you know, look, if you're going to put something up, if you're going to call a guy a murderer, if you're going to say that a woman who died because of a bad heart was having an affair, hurting her family the way you are, you know it to be not true, and you're going to let somebody use your paper. What if they did that in the New York Times? What if they did that in the Boston Globe? Wouldn't they be sued? So I think they should be held to the same standard.
Well, and I think, Will, I think what we know is that what we've seen with things like social media and technology, it's that it's galloped ahead. And it is, I mean, we've never envisioned anything like a Facebook. We never envisioned anything like a Twitter. So when we set up standards, of course it didn't apply there because we could never even have imagined that. And I think that's part of the problem. And now it's biting us in the proverbial butt because we have it's unregulated, and yet it is both incredibly beneficial and incredibly harmful.
Yeah, new information technology is always incredibly disruptive. I mean, the introduction of the printing press, you know, led pretty directly to the downfall of whole regimes. You know, like once people could get information through a mass medium, it changed everything. Right. Like people, it's hard to think through in advance how that's going to work. And we weren't able to think through how social media was going to work, how people were going to be able to use it for political purposes, use it to divide people against each other, use it to perpetuate lies and conspiracies, right? But I think we need to come up with some idea of there being a, you know, an information commons, that there's a certain healthy public sphere of deliberation and discussion is something that has to be, you know,
protected.
Yeah, cultivated and maintained and protected. And what that requires at any given time, given the technologies that we have, is going to be different. I think it's hard to figure out what that is. But if we don't have that kind of healthy public sphere to talk to each other, to persuade each other on sane terms, then we can't have a democracy. It won't work.
And on that note, the operative word was sane terms. Remember that. It's going to stick to you for a long time. All right, this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes, Dean Spiliotis, Will Wilkerson, Rick Newman. Thank you so much. That's why you tune into the show, because we have conversations on sane terms. Talk to you tomorrow. Ciao.